Today is September the 22nd, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank at pcradioshow.org. Millions of AMD PCs affected by a new CPU driver flaw. They need to be patched ASAP. Attackers can easily steal passwords and encryption keys from system memory. After finding several security flaws in Intel's System Guard extensions, security researchers have now revealed a flaw in AMD's platform security processor chipset driver that makes it easy for attackers to steal sensitive data from Ryzen power systems. The good news is there's already patches available from both Microsoft and AMD. Recently, AMD disclosed a vulnerability in the AMD platform security processor chipset driver that allows malicious actors to dump memory pages and exact sensitive information such as passwords and storage decryption keys. The flaw is considered medium severity. It affects a wide range of AMD-powered systems, with all Ryzen desktop, mobile, and workstation CPUs being affected. Additionally, PCs equipped with a 6th or 7th generation AMD A-Series APU or modern Athlon processors are vulnerable to the same attack. Security researcher discovered the flaw back in April. A proof-of-concept exploit on several AMD systems was done and found it relatively easy to leak several gigabytes of uninitialized physical memory pages when logged in as a user with low privileges. At the same time, this attack method can bypass exploitation mitigations like kernel address space layout randomization. One way to ensure you get the patches is to download the latest AMD chipset drivers from AMD's own website. The driver was released a month ago, but at the time, AMD chose not to fully disclose the security fixes contained in the release. Another way to ensure your system is patched against this issue is to install Microsoft's latest Patch Tuesday update. Amazon says it permanently banned 600 Chinese brands for review fraud. These Chinese companies knew what they were doing. Remember when gadget vendors Orki, Empow, RavPower, Vava, Tautronics, and Chotech started mysteriously disappearing from Amazon's online storefront? And it turned out Amazon had intentionally yanked them while vaguely gesturing to the sanctity of its users' reviews. Turns out they were just the tip of the iceberg. Amazon has now permanently banned over 600 Chinese brands across 3,000 different seller accounts. Amazon says that the grand total, after 5 months of its global crackdown, and it's no longer being shy about it, a spokesperson said these 600 brands were banned for knowingly, repeatedly, and significantly violating Amazon's policies, especially the ones around review abuse. The South China Morning Post reported the numbers earlier, citing an interview with Amazon's Asia VP on the state-owned television. Amazon crackdown began amidst reporting by the Wall Street Journal about how companies like RavPower offered gift cards in exchange for reviews. And some people were bragging about collecting cards like this as well. Amazon banned the practice of incentivizing reviews in 2016. But it's a tricky business. Some of these offers are disguised as VIP testing program or an extended warranty. Other companies only offer incentives after you've left a bad review. They'll give you a free product or offer a refund of free money. No return required as long as you delete your negative review. Banned brands are slipping through. It's not clear which other Chinese brands might be included in Amazon's latest crackdown. And it's quite possible some of their products will escape, even though Aukey, that's A-U-K-E-Y, was one of the first high-profile companies to get banned in May. The company was still selling earbuds under a sub-brand as of July, and you can still buy a pair of them on Amazon even today. When Amazon was asked to explain its policies around band dodging, well, let's hope that we'll get some reasonable answer. In early July, the parent company of Shenzhen Yokishu Technology, more commonly known as YKS, reported that Amazon had closed 340 of YKS's online stores and frozen over $20 million worth of its assets, according to South China Morning Post. The publication described YKS as one of the platform's largest Chinese retailers. By the way, here's Amazon's full statement. Amazon works hard to build a great experience in our store so that customers can shop with confidence and sellers have the opportunity to grow their business amid healthy competition. Customers rely on the accuracy and authenticity of product reviews to make informed purchasing decisions, and we have clear policies for both reviewers and selling partners that prohibit abuse of our community features. We suspend, ban, and take legal action against those who violate these policies wherever they are in the world. We will continue to improve abuse detection and take enforcement action against bad actors, including those that knowingly engage in multiple and repeated policy violations, including review abuse. We are confident that the steps we take are in the best interest of our customers as well as the honest business that make up the vast majority of our global selling community. Amazon, thank you for at least now taking a stand. I hope that some of the other online organizations also clear up their reviews and take out some of the bad actors. What I really find disturbing is people are giving a review on a product that was announced but never released nor sold. That's not a legitimate review. WhatsApp's moderators can read your messages. WhatsApp's isn't the impenetrable private messaging service that Facebook would like you to believe. Facebook planted its privacy flag on WhatsApp, the end-to-end encrypted messaging service which Facebook can't spy on. In 2018 Senate hearings, Mark Zuckerberg stated unequivocally that we don't see any of the content in WhatsApp. It's fully encrypted. Today, upon opening the app, a privacy policy update reads, "We can't read or listen to your personal conversations as they are end-to-end encrypted." By the way, the emphasis is theirs. This will never change. This is simply not true. In a new ProPublica report on WhatsApp content moderation system, here's what they found. "We knew that WhatsApp moderators exist, that WhatsApp hands over metadata to law enforcement, and that the company has long shared user data amongst its ecosystem of data-thirsty apps. This report gives a clearer picture of the practices which until now Facebook has deliberately obscured in its attempt to sell users on a privacy-oriented platform. WhatsApp can read some of your messages if the recipient reports them." This leads to a lot of confusion about what the company means when it says end-to-end encryption, which by definition means that only the recipient and sender possess digital tokens allowing a message to become legible. ProPublica notes that at least 1,000 moderators employed by Facebook, moderator contract firm Accenture, review user-reported content that's been flagged by its machine learning system. They monitor for, among other things, spam, disinformation, hate speech, potential terrorist threats, child sexual abuse material, that's now we call CSAM, blackmail, and sexually oriented businesses. Based on the content, moderators can ban the account, put the user on watch, or leave it alone. This is different than Facebook or Instagram, which also allows moderators to remove individual posts. In an op-ed earlier this year, WhatsApp head Will Cathcart wrote that the company submitted 400,000 reports to child safety authorities last year and people have been prosecuted as a consequence. Most can agree that violent imagery and CSAM should be monitored and reported. Facebook and Pornhub regularly generate media scandals for not moderating enough. But WhatsApp moderators told ProPublica that the app's artificial intelligence program sends moderators an inordinate number of harmless posts, like children in bathtubs. Once the flagged content reaches them, ProPublica reports that moderators can see the last 5 messages in the thread. WhatsApp discloses in its term of service that when an account is reported, it receives the most recent messages from the reported group or user, as well as information on your recent interactions with the reported user. This does not specify that such information viewable by the moderators could include phone numbers, profile photos, linked Facebook and Instagram accounts, their IP address, and mobile phone ID. And the report notes, WhatsApp does not disclose the fact that it amasses or uses metadata no matter what their privacy settings are. The collection of messages contradict WhatsApp's big public showing early this year in a lawsuit against the Indian government, fighting a new law that would likely have allowed Indian law enforcement officials to trawl suspects' messages, the company said in a statement shared with Reuters. Requiring messaging apps to trace chats is the equivalent of asking us to keep a fingerprint of every single message sent on WhatsApp, which would break end-to-end encryption and fundamentally undermines people's rights to privacy. But similar to Facebook, WhatsApp does seem enthusiastic about sharing metadata with U.S. law enforcement, including data that has helped shield the government from accountability. In a case against a Treasury Department whistleblower who shared classified documents with BuzzFeed, prosecutors submitted the fact that, well, the individual had exchanged dozens of messages with a reporter around the time of publication. That reporter now faces a 6-month prison sentence. Law enforcement can get a court order subpoena for that information, but WhatsApp can also choose not to store the information. Its competitor Signal claims the only metadata it collects is your contact information. If WhatsApp offered Signal's signature to encrypt metadata as well, the company wouldn't be able to share anything if they wanted to. WhatsApp didn't offer much clarity on what mechanism it uses to receive decrypted messages, only that the person tapping the report button is automatically generating a new message between themselves and WhatsApp. That seems to indicate that WhatsApp is deploying a sort of copy and paste function, but the details are still unclear. Facebook told Gizmodo that WhatsApp can read messages because they're considered a version of direct messaging between the company and the reporter. They added that users who report content make the conscious choice to share information with Facebook. By their logic, Facebook's collection of that material doesn't conflict with end-to-end encryption. So yes, WhatsApp can see your messages without your consent. Do you trust big tech now with your information and your data? Apple confirms embarrassing MacBook Pro design problem. Why have MacBook screens been cracking unexpectedly? Since the launch of the new Apple Silicon-powered MacBook Air and MacBook Pro laptops in late 2020, some users have been reporting mysterious cracks appearing in the screens. Now Apple has confirmed what is causing the issue. Following multiple user reports on its forum and in other MacBook communities, Apple has quietly acknowledged that issue is in its support documentation. To enable the thin design of Mac notebook computers, the clearance between the display screen and the top case is engineered to tight tolerances. If you use a camera cover, palm rest cover, or keyboard cover with your Mac notebook, remove the cover before closing your display. Leave any material on your display, keyboard, or palm rest might interfere with the display when it's closed and cause damage to your display. While Apple has tacitly confirmed how displays are being damaged, the root cause of the problem is not with MacBook Air and MacBook Pro owners. It lies with Apple pushing the limits of design in a quest to make its laptops as thin as possible. While they may look gorgeous on stage, in marketing shots and on display in the Apple Store, any MacBook is an expensive investment for many consumers who can pay close to $3,000 for some of the highly spec models, and they are going to want to protect their new laptops from the dings and scrapes of modern life. Apple has an extensive selection of third-party cases and covers on sale, although look through the list shows a lack of keyboard, palm rest, or camera covers. The closest you get to anything that would disrupt the closed space between keyboard and screen would be the clips that a hard case shell used to secure the shell to the body of the laptop, or the screen privacy guard that reduces the viewability angle of the screen. But it's the design of the MacBook Pro and MacBook Air that is contributing to the problem. No matter how the laptop looks, everyone can see the voracious appetite for protective cases in the marketplace. They are part of the ecosystem, and as such, they should be part of the design consideration. To reduce the tolerances between the two sides of the laptop to enable the thin design does not feel as if it was a customer-led decision. You can either follow Apple's design goals and leave your laptop naked, or you can do the sensible thing for your bank balance and accept the risk that Apple's tight tolerances around design may cripple your laptop. Thankfully, the new MacBook Pro design is just around the corner, and hopefully the new design will debut on the 14-inch and 16-inch MacBook Pro laptops with more accommodating to the business of life than the ideals of imagination. Can you imagine this all happening with Apple? Microsoft doubles down on TPM 2.0 for Windows 11. Ship date for Windows 11 is October the 5th. Microsoft is holding firm on needing the hardware function of the Trusted Module Platform. That's TPM. It doesn't look like Microsoft will change its mind before Windows 11 is shipped. It is looking increasingly likely that Microsoft will stick with Trusted Module Platform 2.0 requirement, at least initially. Who knows what Microsoft may decide down the line? For now, however, Microsoft isn't budging. Microsoft explains that most PCs shipped over the past 5 years have the ability to run TPM 2.0 as required by Windows 11, but in many cases they are not configured to do so. This is especially true in the do-it-yourself sector, since this has never been much of an issue before. Motherboard makers were not in the habit of enabling TPM 2.0 by default, even though it is almost always available as an option in the BIOS. Microsoft noted that to enable TPM 2.0 in the BIOS, the option is usually found within sections labeled Advanced, Security, or Trusted Computing. Once there, the option could have one of several different names, including Security Device, Security Device Support, TPM State, an FTPM Switch, and AMD PSP. It is like asking the average PC user to digest all those different forms of reference to TPM. You can't expect that. For the average consumer, many may have never entered into a BIOS or even know what a BIOS is. Microsoft messaging lacks clarity. 1 week, it's cutting off support at Intel's 8th generation CPUs and the 2nd generation AMD Ryzen chips. Then the next week, it's adding 7th generation Core CPUs to the compatibility list, but only some of them, mostly certain Xeon chips, save for the Core i7-7820HQ, a mobile CPU that just so happens to be employed by Microsoft's Surface Studio 2 system. Go figure. For an outsider, there is an arbitrariness to the decision-making process. In a separate blog post, Microsoft explains that on unsupported devices, it observed 52% more kernel mode crashes when testing Windows 11, whereas devices that do meet the minimum system requirements had a 99.8% crash-free experience. But does that mean that Core i7-7820HQ is for some reason able to provide a more stable experience in Windows 11 than other 7th generation chips? Why is it exempt while other 7th generation chips are not? In the meantime, the PC Health Check app that Microsoft released and then yanked offline after people were confused why their PCs were failing the tests, well, heads up, it's available to download again in preview form. So my advice is very simple. When Windows 11 is finally released, I would not rush to the head of the line to have it installed. Microsoft says it won't support Windows 11 on M1 Macs. A Microsoft spokesperson had said that running Windows 11 on a PC with an Apple M1 is not a supported scenario. The thing that wasn't supported with Windows 10 won't be supported with Windows 11. To be clear, that statement does not mean that running Windows 11 on an M1 Mac won't work, at least through virtualization solutions like Parallels. It only means that it's not supported. If something goes wrong and you try to contact Microsoft support, they can tell you that it's your problem. Here's the deal. Microsoft currently doesn't offer ISO images for Windows on ARM. In other words, those reduced instruction set processors. What you can get is a VHDX file for a Windows Insider Preview build that's meant to be used in a virtual machine. This is a file that you use to get Windows 11 up and running in Parallels on your M1 Mac. However, that wasn't the original intent when Microsoft started publishing them. It's because beginning with Windows 10 Insider Preview build 19559, the Redmond firm started offering Hyper-V on ARM devices. In order to run a virtual machine on a Windows on ARM PC, you need an ARM image, just like on an M1 Mac. That's why the company started releasing virtual hard disk of Windows on ARM builds. Obviously, that happened in early 2020, and here we are, Hyper-V for Windows on ARM hasn't shipped to non-insiders yet. This was due to a variety of reasons that led to Windows 10 getting enablement package updates instead of actual feature updates. You'll notice that even with the Windows 10 version 21H2 update that's coming soon, the build number 19044 is still lower than the very first build to get Hyper-V on ARM. That Windows 10 development branch eventually became Windows 11. When the new OS ships on October the 5th, ARM PCs will have Hyper-V support. Presumably, that means Microsoft will start offering production VHDX images at that point. Here's a pro tip. The one currently being offered to insiders is going to be the production image. Now that we talked about Windows on ARM, images for it, and why they exist, you might be wondering what's stopping you from installing Windows 11 on your M1 Mac. The truth is, nothing is stopping you right now. Windows 11 does have a more strict list of CPUs that it runs on, and on the ARM side of things, that includes chipsets made by Qualcomm, with the exception of the Snapdragon 835. The Apple M1 simply isn't a supported processor, although Parallels does say that it officially supports Windows 11. It's easy for Parallels to say because they don't have to support Windows 11. Microsoft has also said that if you install Windows 11 with a fresh media, it's not going to check to make sure that you have a supported processor. It's just going to, you guessed it, leave you with an unsupported scenario. Like I said, come October 5th, when Windows 11 is released, don't get to the head of the line. The FCC wants landlords to open up internet competition. U.S. landlords often strike cozy arrangements with big ISPs, blocking broadband competition. The FCC says it's taking a fresh look at an old problem. The FCC has announced it's investigating deals the broadband industry strikes with landlords that block broadband competition in apartment complexes, condos, and developments. While the FCC passed rules in 2008 attempting to prevent such deals, internet service providers have exploited massive loopholes in the restrictions for more than a decade. With more than one-third of the U.S. population living in condos and apartment buildings, it's time to take a fresh look at how exclusive agreements between carriers and building owners could lock out broadband competition and consumer choice. The inquiry comes after President Biden signed an executive order in July urging regulators to take a closer look at competition and monopoly issues in several sectors. The order also mandated the creation of a competition council, which urged the FCC to take a closer look at the anti-competitive nature of these arrangements. The FCC's existing rules technically bar landlords and ISPs from colluding to restrict broadband competition, but there are various ways big telecom wiggles around the restrictions, often by simply calling what they're doing something else. For example, to get around FCC rules expanding access to an ISP's in-building wiring, companies like Comcast or Charter will often deed ownership of these wires to a landlord, then turn around and pay that landlord to ensure that nobody else can have access. Because the landlord now technically owns the wires, the FCC rules no longer apply. ISP also pay landlords to sign agreements that ban any other competing ISPs from advertising in the building. In addition, many landlords will charge door fees to any company that needs access to a building to install new wiring, creating an additional layer of difficulty and expense for smaller broadband competitors trying to compete with dominant ISPs. Collectively, such restrictions serve the same function as blocking broadband competition outright, much as it does on the national level. This lack of block-by-block competition directly contributes to higher prices, slower speed, and often poor customer service. In response, a growing number of towns and cities are building their own broadband networks from scratch. But even these new entrants may find access to consumers prohibited by annoying building-by-building restrictions erected by major ISPs. But consumer groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Public Knowledge have long argued, backed with ample evidence, that such deals are little more than glorified kickbacks to apartment owners in exchange for keeping competition at bay. Granted, just because the FCC is now fielding public input on the problem doesn't mean it will actually get the problem fixed. A 2017 notice of inquiry into the problem by the FCC, similar to this, went nowhere. Still, the FCC's public notice urges consumers who've run into these kinds of anti-competitive building restrictions to tell the FCC about it within the next 30 days. Those looking to comment should read the FCC instructions for commenting. Note the docket number, which is 17-142. In other words, you go to the FCC.gov site and look up the docket number 17-142, then submit a comment by mail, email, or via the FCC website. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series, Social Security Administration Spying on Employees.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we start talking about technology and how it impacts us in the workplace. Now, this topic, I'm not going to come back to this. I am going to come back to this sometime scattered over the course of the rest of this quarter. I'm going to hit on this at least a couple of more times between now and the end of the year, I should say, because this is kind of an issue that people talk about on a regular basis. And I don't know why I haven't really spent more time involved with this in this particular segment. Now, a part of this goes back to something. Okay, we probably know this. Our government does at times spy on us. Even who I'm going to talk about, to the Social Security Administration. Yes, they spy on people. Okay, they're spying on people who are making disability claims, and that's all in the interest of making sure that, people make disability claims all the time because they figure deep pockets and it can, yeah, anyways. But they're also spying on their employees. Let me say that again. The Social Security Administration, they have admitted that they are going through and they are monitoring all of their employees. Let me double down on this. Okay. They're actually this is the tip of the iceberg, because after their success, they've reached out to OMB and GSA, and they're calling upon both of those agencies to gather data by surveying their workforces directly. Now, this was covert. The Social Security Administration's Inspector General Office, they went through and they conducted a bunch of surveys. They went through the computer logs. They went through telephone records. They went through everything they could find, technologically wise, to make sure employees were working, that they were actually doing work when they were supposed to be working. All right, now I do want people to be working when they're supposed to be working. Do not mistake my comments here as a permission to go ahead and loaf off, to goof off, to do whatever you want. The issue here, however, is that the reports that have come down from a number of folks is that employees all over have been dismissed for their actions, or rather lack thereof, based upon secretive data, with managers finding out that, for instance, field employees were being let go because they didn't do any work online. Field employees that would not normally be online. Go figure. Okay, so they support this. The Social Security Administration, one of their representatives said, oh, as stewards of taxpayer dollars, we need to hold employees accountable when appropriate. Now, okay, so we will get into this in future coverage in regards to, yes, regular Wall Street companies, they are going to be caretakers of stockholder interests. However, there's a lot that's going on within the Social Security Administration in that they're going through and they are, again, they're letting people go without really figuring out the truth behind all of this. They're kind of running roughshod according to a couple of different news sources that I found on this. And also, basically, once people went home and they started working from home roughly 18 months ago, according to various insiders, top officials threatened severe punishments for anyone not working hard enough, or one of the words used was dutifully. Yes, dutifully. That's kind of a vague word. So tracking was instituted across the board. Open tracking, you would start your day by telling your boss via email what you're going to do, and then end your day with your list of accomplishments. This is micromanagement. This is some serious stuff. And I mean, for problem employees, that's one thing. But when you start saying across the board, we're going to do this. Yes, today I filled out 17 emails to various people who were looking to make sure that they're filling, you know, out the proper forms. I responded to 42 phone calls. No, I'm sorry, 43 phone calls. No, look. This is micromanagement. But you would think that would be the end of it. No, because again, we go back into this whole spying thing. So they put the tech to use and they used undocumented methods with vague phrases like data analysis. Now, we've heard data analysis before, and that's all fine and dandy if you're just saying data analysis shows us this, but you can usually back this up. But managers are saying that, yeah, they aren't backing up anything. They're just getting dismissal letters. Can this person? They weren't working on company time. They should have been working on company time, to the extent that since the pandemic started, the Social Security Administration's Inspector General's office, they opened 8,000 cases. Now, normally when you're an employee, that would be where it would be, you know, you would be terminated. But no, they actually made 228 arrests. They obtained 828 convictions. George Orwell's 1984 talked about the entire population being spied upon, but specifically called out where the government had cameras in every working environment for employee surveillance. This is getting there. This is getting on a creepy level. Just saying. Spied on by anonymous people and getting anonymous dismissal letters. We'll get back to this again sometime soon. As for now, back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. My granddaughter was notified this past July of return to classes at one of the University of California schools. That was the good news. The bad news is the number of people in the dormitory suite had been reduced. Priority was given to foreign students attending the school. Students who are juniors and seniors and are state residents need to find accommodations off campus. Thousands of UC students struggle to find housing. Campus administrators are still scrambling to solve the problem. Administrators are negotiating with local hotels to make rooms available to those who cannot find suitable housing elsewhere. But even that would be only a short-term solution, as those rooms would only be available for the fall quarter. The reason students have struggled to find off-campus housing is because of changes in leasing patterns. Houses in pre-pandemic years typically housed 16 students, are now housing about 10 students. Students in those houses are willing to pay higher rent prices to live in less crowded housing and mitigate the risk of COVID-19 spreading, and then that was just causing more shortages. Some students are living in their car. Some students may forego attending classes altogether this fall if they can't find somewhere to live. For many seeking housing, it's especially disappointing because after more than a year of living and taking classes at home, they were all looking forward to finally being on their own. My granddaughter eventually found housing, but only to find that there was no internet service at the location. There are three ways, however, to solve this problem. The first one is definitely not recommended. That is a hangout where free Wi-Fi is available. With the restrictions in place, there is not really a safe establishment that is readily open when internet is needed. One solution is to use your cell phone as a mobile hotspot. You can easily tether a laptop or tablet to your mobile phone to connect to the internet. This is a common scenario. You're away from a stable Wi-Fi connection and need to get work done on a screen that's larger than your mobile phone. You have a tablet or a laptop at the ready, but no cellular connectivity on those devices, which means no way to connect to the internet. Or so you thought. If your mobile phone cellular data plan includes mobile hotspot support, you can easily let your larger device tap into the internet data from your mobile phone. There are a couple of caveats, though. Using up your mobile phone data will drain your battery's life, and your plan may only support up to a certain amount of hotspot data per month. So make sure you watch your usage and plan to charge up your phone once you've done working. If you need internet access for a sustained period of time, an alternative is the monthly lease of a hotspot unit from the carrier. What do you need to know about mobile hotspot devices? They are a cellular modem and router combined. Most can create their own personal Wi-Fi network. They are typically designed for a specific cellular carrier, sold by the carrier themselves or their resellers, and require a suitable cellular data-only plan of their own to operate. Mobile hotspots don't perform any other task other than providing an internet connection using cellular signal. They can't make phone calls. They don't run apps. And while some can receive texts, sending them is impossible. Most mobile hotspots tend to be able to distribute an internet connection over Wi-Fi to between 5 to 15 devices at once. Mobile hotspots can usually be directly tethered via USB into a cellular aware router, becoming the internet source for your local area network. Some even come with an Ethernet port, making them usable as a WAN source, even to more traditional residential routers. They may have a battery built into the device, which allows you to take it with you when on the go. Some even allow you to charge other devices. But their primary purpose is being dedicated data device for getting online over a cellular signal. Who are these hotspot units for? Well, here are some of the scenarios in which a mobile hotspot device might make sense for you, as compared to hotspot off a smartphone or going with a higher-end cellular embedded router. If you have more than one device in your household to keep online, then a dedicated data source may be more reliable and easier to use than hotspot off a mobile phone. Many mobile hotspot models come with antenna ports, giving you the option to use external antennas, which often outperform pricier cellular boosters. Smartphones don't have ports, so you can only use cellular boosters with them. If you want remote access to your automobile, or you may be out exploring, having a data plan on a dedicated data device means you can leave it behind and take your smartphone with you. Portability. If you want to take your internet with you, mobile hotspots are very mobile. Many have built-in batteries, so they're great for sticking in a bag or a vehicle if you need to go find a better signal. There are data plan requirements. Some data plans are only available on mobile hotspot devices, so you may not have a choice. They are easily upgradable. Consumer devices tend to be updated more often than enterprise solutions like routers. So if you want the latest modem features, using hotspot devices is a more affordable way to quickly upgrade your mobile internet arsenal. These units tend to be priced from, anywhere from $80 on up, as opposed to expensive cellular embedded mobile routers in the $600 plus range. What are the downsides of a mobile hotspot? Well, there are some cons in using a mobile hotspot device that you got to keep in mind. You'll have the expense of a hardware purchase in addition to the smartphone you might carry with you already. A hotspot will also need its own data plan, and typically only plans designated for use in data-only devices are compatible. While smartphone and tablet plans may be unlimited, many plans for data-only hotspot devices and routers have hard limits. There is a limited range beyond that, as Wi-Fi radios just aren't overly strong. This solution isn't optimal for those who want a solid signal further away than the size of a moderate household room. For my granddaughter, the extra cost of internet service is part of the additional cost to absorb for a college education during this pandemic period. An op-ed by Benjamin Rockwell. Technology detection of COVID could be freedom thief.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com. ComputerTalkRadio.com. Now, you've been listening to me for a number of years, hopefully. Or maybe you're new to listening to me, and that's okay. I'm going to go in a direction where I, as the nerd, I'm going to apply some of my past experience into a technical situation. So I think what's coming is going to be in the tech industry. Now, it may be in a biotech industry, but it's going to come from technology. And this is a missing key that I see right now in regards to the entire COVID situation. And maybe we'll deal with this. Maybe it'll be a future disease, but we've gone through and we know how to clean. And yes, there's all of these discussions we've had. We've talked about the UVC cleaning and stuff like that, but tech likes to be a savior for all of the problems that ail us. They like to come along. The tech industry has tons of money. Whether we're talking Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or whoever, we all see these guys throwing huge amounts of money at problems thinking that they can fix it. And I think we're going to see them filling in some of the gaps here in the coming year or so, depending on how long COVID goes and how long it takes for them to apply technology to this. So in incident response, whenever we have a tech incident, there's a lot of preparation. Then we go through detection and analysis, and we go through containment, eradication, and then recovery. You get a computer virus, you're going to go through a lot of these different things. Are you and I ready for the tech industry to go through and do a drive on real-time detection of COVID? Because we don't have real time. The current time for COVID detection is, you know, you go, you do the nasal swab, it takes 20 minutes for them to get the response back, and it's uncomfortable, and what are you going to do for that next 20 minutes? And that's even not even, it's something that is, it's a very active item. And I think we're going to see people working on more of passive detection, a matter of detecting people as they walk into a room, as they go through and they walk into the mall. No, in more contained spaces. Let's talk about the workplace. No, a movie theater or a school. All right. So how do we address this? There's a detection. Let's go with schools. What kinds of plans have we put into place for schools? I mean, we're treating this as a distinct contagion, which can take lives. It's not like a major item where, okay, if we detect this, everybody's going to be doomed. But we do want to get ahead of this. We want to control this. So there are a lot of different things that we're going to go through. All right, so passive detection. Okay, we've got 30 kids wandering into a classroom. One of these 30 kids has COVID. We've detected COVID entering the room. What do we do next? We're going to forcibly go through and shove nasal swabs into their noses. What next? So we're going to contain them in this room. Okay, well, containing them also creates a situation where they have this, and now they're going to get other kids sick. That's a problem. And we're going to quarantine them, isolate them down. And what next? Do we say, let's take away the phones from the kids? We can't allow them to call the parents. Of course, you know, the parents would be livid too, because now you've started to encroach on the rights of the children here. And what about security? All of a sudden, we're going to be doing lockdowns. We're going to call the cops. Let's call the cops. One of these kids has COVID. Is that a wise idea? Is this something that we really want to be doing? I don't know. None of this is easy. None of this is good. I want us to think about what these next steps are. What about the workplace? I mean, you know, today, if we think somebody's sick, we send them home. But this is something where you typically don't send kids home without knowing something. And especially you can't send home, okay, we've got 30, 40, 50 people in this office section. We're going to send everybody home. Okay, I know this is inevitable. Biotech companies and regular tech companies are surely chasing after this. But we need to set frameworks in place that respect us as individuals. People are likely to... I take that back. People will ignore protocols because they don't believe in them. They will misbehave because of the protection of their own interests, their children, their own self-interests of not being, they don't want to be thrown in the back of the virus paddy wagon, for lack of a better description. They don't want to be quarantined. And all of this is more important to them than all of the rules that will have to be created. We're not going to change behaviors, but I think we need to prepare and we need to plan this carefully and in a direction that is, I'm in support of freedom. I am in support of us doing that which is needed without giving up our liberties, without going through draconian measures. I want you to think about, you may have seen, there's this video of this, I think it's a 10-year-old. I recall they say, oh, she's under 12. She doesn't have to wear a mask. And the cops have thrown this kid down on the cement. And they're in the middle of arresting a kid because she's not wearing a mask. Is this what we want in our country? Is this what we want coming here? All for the sake of stopping this plague? You and I, we need to work together. We need to ensure that our own ability to be free is retained. I want us to work together, and I want us to think about these things. And I'm putting this out here because I don't know what direction we're going to go in. But I have this scary thought in my mind that if we get this tech, that we're going to go forward and somebody's going to say, oh, it's so cool that we did this without thinking about all of the implications that come from beyond this. Yes, let's go ahead and let's detect it in the classroom. Let's lock the classroom down. We'll seal it off and we will quarantine all of these kids in this classroom for the next 2 hours. What? I mean, this is something that we are likely to see, because tech industry goes forward at a rapid pace and they try to fix things, but they don't always apply common sense. They don't always think about every implication of what they're doing. I'm in the IT industry. I know this. I see this firsthand. I see people just running along and saying, oh, I'm just going to take care of this. I know the right fix for this. And, well, you haven't discussed this with anybody. You haven't thought about the other ramifications of what you're going to be doing. You can create a disaster here. And that disaster in this case could be our freedoms. There's a lot to talk about here. I want to know, I want to think about, all of us to think about creating awareness in the workplace, our schools, our society. So, look, with anything on my show, you have my permission to share this freely. You can share the podcast. Tell people, check out the podcast for this day, right here, for today. Let people know that we need to get ahead of whatever tech is coming at us, and we need to create the right protocols in advance to ensure that our freedoms are kept. That's my request to you. But who am I? Benjamin Rockwell, a simple nerd, the host of Computer Talk Radio.
Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Thursday, September the 23rd at 6:45 p.m. It's Virtual Private Network. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 1st at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Their website is acgnj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, October the 7th at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, October the 8th. Meeting time, 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website, limac.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, October the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.